A man built very much like Hammond sprang up on the other side of the Cadillac, a stubby black pistol in hand. Mary ducked behind the car as he squeezed off two quick shots over the roof. The driver dropped onto his knees beside her, his arms wrapped around his head, and cried out to God and Mother Mary and Jesus Christ. Mary, her ears ringing from the gunfire and throbbing from the thunder of her own heartbeat, scurried around to put the open door between her and the trunk, from where she expected, from where she hoped the next volley would come. She peered through the window. "Please, dear God, I hope it's bulletproof," and resigned herself to giving a Sturbridge police detective a few pieces of hard evidence to be used against her in a court of law. Two shapes came into view, one a smaller shadow to the other. The bodyguard never noticed Julie, clad in her poor man's ninja ensemble, until she drove her sword into his back, right between the shoulder blades. The point sprang out from the center of his chest, and then, as quickly, withdrew, eliciting from him a startled grunt. He crumpled in slow motion, as if deflating, a dark rose blooming across his white dress shirt. Mary stood and nodded a thank you. Julie raised her sword in salute, then pointed it at the driver, a question in the gesture. Mary drew a finger across her throat. No mercy. The second execution was as swift and as painless as the first. "Take his gun," Mary said, adding in a flash of inspiration, "and his phone." Ham sat in the dead center of the back seat, his fingers gouging the leather. He glowered at Mary, a defiant facade as thin as paper, as weightless as a feather.
"Valdemar sent you, didn't he?" he wheezed. "Fucking bastard Valdemar sent you, didn't he?"
"Get out," Mary said. Ham did as ordered. Julie marched him over to the Suburban, at the point of her sword, slick with the blood of two men who paid the highest price for their loyalty. Mary lashed his wrists and ankles together with duct tape, and then partially mummified his head so he could neither see nor speak. She and Julie rolled him into the bed of the SUV and shut him in.
"If he acts up?" Julie asked.
"Make him behave," Mary said. "But don't make him bleed." Julie climbed into the back seat, ready to administer blunt force trauma discipline with the head of her cane. Mary backed the Suburban up, taking care not to let the rear tires fall off the asphalt, where they might leave an impression in the soft dirt shoulder, and then sped away. She watched the Ham estate, dark and silent, shrink in her rearview mirror until it vanished from sight. She drew a breath, a sigh of relief in reverse, while Julie expressed her elation as a howl of nigh-maniacal laughter.
"Two people are dead," Mary scolded.
"And neither of them are us," Julie said.
Mary scowled. The night wasn't over yet. Julie stripped out of her makeshift disguise en route to the rendezvous, the last service plaza on the turnpike before Worcester, and threw everything into a garbage bag, which she deposited into a garbage can before getting into Anne's waiting car. Before leaving for their next destination, Mary collected Julie's phone and pistol-whipped it to pieces on the floor of the SUV. Those pieces went out the window a handful at a time as she drove back to the city, back to the not-so-abandoned former factory turned House of Horrors. Anne parked at the end of the road to wait. Mary stopped at the front gate and pondered the latest item on her seemingly endless checklist of calculated risks. Rose's father, an amateur astronomer, called this time of day civil twilight. The sun had just finished its nightly disappearing act, but the sky was more day than night, and would be for an hour or so more. The decision before her: wait for the cover of darkness, or trust in the factory's relative seclusion to conceal what she was to do next. Ham brought her internal debate to an end when he screamed through his duct tape gag and lashed out with his bound feet, striking the rear windshield hard enough to crack it. Mary threw the SUV into reverse, then slammed it into drive and stomped on the accelerator. The Suburban snapped the chain-link swing gate off its hasp, never slowing. The garage bay door presented little more of a challenge. The SUV ripped the roll-up door clean off its tracks. It flipped up like a curtain caught in a stiff wind and fell back into place, the steely crash reverberating off the cinder-block walls. The vehicle threatened to spin out. Mary threw her entire body behind a final pull of the steering wheel, bringing the beast under control to guide its final run straight into the meat locker. The passenger's side corner punched through the door and rendered a section of the surrounding wall concave. Ham shrieked. It came out as a muffled and incomprehensible keen, but Mary was sure he'd called her a crazy fucking cunt. She backed out of the fissure and killed the engine. A cinder block came loose and fell with a chalky thud. She slipped the painter's booties on over her feet and got out. She pulled her bandana back up over her face to keep at bay the stomach-churning miasma that gushed forth from the meat locker, carried on a rolling mist of condensation spilling out across the floor. Ham, possessed of an older man's doughy physique, would have been difficult to wrestle out of the Suburban even if he cooperated, which he didn't. The instant Mary laid a hand on him, he kicked at her, catching her on the knuckles. Cursing, Mary grasped Ham by the ankles and hauled him out. His head hit the cement floor with a satisfying smack. She ripped the duct tape away from his mouth so she could fully enjoy the profane tirade that spilled out of him.
"You fucking bitch, whore! I'll fucking gut you, you fucking cunt! You fucking whore!"
He drew a breath for a second round, but gagged on the air, thick and heavy and sour. He retched several times, like a cat preparing to bring up a hairball, and then surrendered the contents of his stomach. Mary did a skipping step back to avoid the spray.
"Oh, Christ," he moaned. "Oh, Christ, what is that? What is that?"
Mary retrieved her machete from the front seat of the SUV. She grabbed Ham by his thinning hair and pulled him up to his knees, then raised the blade high. This was all about survival.
"It's hell," she said.
The first swing cleaved into, but not through, the vertebrae at the base of Ham's skull. Mary pulled the machete free. Ham pitched onto his face, blood spurting rhythmically from the wound. A throe rippled down his body. Mary brought the blade down again, and again, and again. It took 7 strokes to completely decapitate Octavio Ham. The phone Julie took off Ham's bodyguard was tacky with drying blood. She used Ham's finger to dial 911 and set the phone down on his body. The head went into a tripled-up garbage bag, and this went into the duffel bag. Mary slipped into her pocket 1 more garbage bag, into which she would stuff her coveralls and boots as soon as she was off the property, and that would go into the first dumpster she could find. It would take investigators a while to figure out who owned the building. Valdemar likely purchased it through back channels and slapped a fictional owner's name on all the paperwork. But eventually, the paper trail would lead back to him. When in Anne and Julie's presence, Mary referred to this as her contingency, should the main plan go terribly awry and they failed to bring Valdemar down. Privately, she called it revenge from beyond the grave. 25. Mary pressed the glowing white button on the call box and stepped back to wait. She glanced up. A security camera peered over the wrought iron fence surrounding the Valdemar house. She flashed a pleasant smile. A few minutes later, Hammond marched down from the house, his fists balled.
"Do you ever take off that suit?" Mary said. "You sleep in that thing, don't you?" "What the hell are you doing here?" Hammond said. "This is not how we do business."
"I have something for Valdemar, and believe me, this time I really do have to give it to him personally."
"Then we'll make arrangements to do it tomorrow, discreetly."
"I don't think Octavio Ham's head will keep until tomorrow."
"Ham's what?"
Mary held up a finger. 1 minute. She returned to the Mazda and retrieved her duffel bag from the back seat. She set it down in front of the gate and opened it to reveal the plastic-wrapped prize inside.
"Open it. Let me see," Hammond said.
"I know Valdemar doesn't really have much in the way of neighbors." Mary looked around. The property was as secluded as Ham's. "But do you really want me to hold up a severed human head out in the great wide open?" Hammond chewed on his bottom lip a bit, then gestured at Mary to get her hands up and turn around. She did a slow spin, showing Hammond the Glock in its holster. "What do you think? Do these jeans make my gun look big?" Mary said.
"Back it up," he said.
She complied. Hammond took the gun, holster and all, before opening the gate.
"You try anything," he warned.
Yes, yes, torture and death await, big scary man.
Hammond rode shotgun for the short drive up to the house. He made the most of their brief time together to glower balefully at Mary, who returned the unspoken sentiment by blowing him a kiss.
You really think you'll get to walk away from all this, don't you? Hammond said.
I guess we'll find out, won't we?
Guess we will.
Mr. Hammond?
What?
If you're right and I don't walk away, Mary grinned, I will make bloody well sure you don't either.
Erkan and Isabel entered the living room side by side, in their almost matching silk robes. His was black with red accents, hers the reverse, to find Mary lazing on the couch as if posing for a boudoir photographer. Hammond hovered nearby.
Mr. Valdemar, she said, with but a token attempt at sincere respect. Lady Valdemar.
What are you doing here, Sergeant? Erkan said.
Making good on my end of our arrangement.
She flicked a hand at the duffel bag sitting on the coffee table. Valdemar told his man to open it. Hammond circled around to do the honors, taking care to never let Mary out of his sight. He lifted out an object the approximate size of a bowling ball. He ran his hands over the bag, feeling the contours, then undid the fat knot at the top and gazed inside.
Well, fuck me, he said mildly. Mr. Hammond, Erkan said.
Hammond pulled aside the wrappings. The bloodless but blood-spattered face of Octavio Ham stared at the Valdemars, his eyes lifeless yet somehow accusing.
Erkan, Isabel said, a smile forming.
She did it, Erkan said, and then to Mary. You killed him.
Add him to your collection, Mary said, rising. I did what you asked.
One moment, Sergeant.
Erkan folded the garbage bags around his new trophy and set it on the table.
I know what you're going to say.
Do you?
You want me to let you go. That's not unreasonable or unexpected, but I ask you to hear me out. You've served me very well, better than I expected, truth be told. I'd like to retain you indefinitely.
And why would I agree to that?
Because you know what I do.
Oh, I know what you do, all right.
Not that. You know what I do for this city. I protect it in ways no one else ever has or ever could. I've made it safer for everyone who lives and works here, including you and your brothers and sisters in blue. But there's still work to be done.
Erkan spread his arms theatrically.
There are more Octavio Hams out there, men who would love to plunge Worcester back into darkness for their own selfish gratification. If I'm to keep such men at bay, I need all the help I can get. People like you, who will do whatever it takes to protect the city and its people.
In the days leading up to this evening, Mary spent many sleepless hours imagining this very conversation and how it might play out. In every conjured scenario, she faced powerful temptation to side with the devil calling himself Erkan Valdemar, and every time she wound up standing at the edge of an abyss as dark as a lake of blood, ready to throw herself in. Whatever it takes, Mr. Valdemar? Even if what it takes is threatening to casually slaughter innocent people? Mary said. Erkan gave a small shrug, as if he didn't understand her point. That was all the answer Mary needed. Calculated risk the sixth. That she could rile Hammond badly enough, he'd get careless, and wouldn't think to thoroughly search the duffel bag, where he would have discovered the machete lying in the bottom, along with her burner phone, which was connected to its remaining mate in the trunk of Anne's car, which Hammond also failed to search.
Monsieur Valdemar, Julie said, touching the tip of her sword to the base of Erkan's neck. A pleasure.
Isabel turned and found herself staring down the barrel of the Glock scavenged from Ham's bodyguard. Anne spun her back around and pressed the gun to the base of her skull.
Lay down your arms, Hammond, Mary said.
Hammond, simmering, set down on the coffee table Mary's Glock and then his own Sig Sauer. The former she clipped back onto her belt, the latter she leveled at Hammond, from a distance. In her experience, big men tended to be faster than their bulk suggested.
"Now what do you intend to do, Sergeant?" Isabel said. Turn us in? I think you know how that would end.
Indeed I do, Lady Voldemar. That's why your husband is going to make a call to the colleague in possession of your hit list, and order him to recall every...
How did you put it? Mary said to Erkan.
Every contractor you dispatched?
And then tell him to destroy the list, because you've had a change of heart and decided to let me go my merry way.
Or you'll kill me, Erkan said. Is that it?
Oh, no.
Mary retrieved her machete, and, after tugging the Sig Sauer under her belt, flicked the sheath off with a snap of her wrist.
Or I'll start with your toes and work my way up.
I will dismantle you, Voldemar, one piece at a time, until you beg me to kill you. But I won't. Not until you call off your dogs.
I don't think you're that barbaric, Sergeant, Erkan said with an easy smile.
The severed head sitting on your coffee table begs to differ. Erkan's lips shriveled at the edges.
Let's find out. I know how far I'm willing to go. I'm curious to see how far you'll go.
Erkan, Isabel said.
Shh, it'll be all right.
Erkan faced Mary with steely defiance.
You won't do it, Sergeant.
Mary raised her machete and let Voldemar get a good look at it before she struck. The blade split Isabel's bare foot up the middle, between the second and third toes. Her porcelain complexion turned instantly red, and she let out a wail. A wail her husband echoed in volume. He lunged for Mary. She sidestepped his charge and slapped the flat of the machete across his head, sending him sprawling. Isabel toppled over, mirroring her husband. Mary stepped on her back, pinning her to the floor.
No,
Erkan cried.
Leave her alone.
Oh, now you have a problem with threatening an innocent, Mary said,
and she uttered a pitiless laugh. You wanted to see how far I'd go, Voldemar.
You still game?
I am.
Let her go, please let her go, Voldemar whimpered. I'll do anything, anything, but please don't hurt her.
Make the call. Make the call, or I swear to God I will— Mary blinked, a revelation striking her with the explosive ferocity of a lightning bolt from on high. Erkan Voldemar rose up to his knees, tremulous hands out in a beggar's plea, tears pooling in the corners of his maddened, desperate eyes. His hair, usually immaculate, was a wild, tangled mane. This pathetic, craven man wasn't worthy of awe or respect, or certainly not fear. He was nothing but a normal human being.
It's not him, Mary said.
Isabel crawled out from underfoot and clambered over to Erkan, into his arms, and threw at Mary a glare possessed of the blistering fury of a volcano on the edge of eruption.
Mary?
Anne said.
It's not him, Mary said again. It's her.
Mary caught a flash of motion out of the corner of her eye. Hammond, lunging, reaching. She spat a startled curse as she twisted aside. The bag containing Ham's head hurtled past, narrowly missing her. Hammond closed the distance in leaping strides. He lowered his shoulder for a crushing body check that sent Anne flying, and sent her gun flying out of her hand. Mary came in swinging. Hammond pivoted, grasped her arm, and launched her over his hip. She landed hard on her tailbone, sending an electric shock up her spine. Julie attacked, the tip of her sword whistling toward Hammond's heart. He sidestepped and responded with a stiff jab, his knuckles cracking against Julie's cheekbone. A sledgehammer left mashed her nose. Hammond grasped Mary's wrist and hauled her to her feet. Something in her shoulder popped, sending fire down her arm and into her chest. Hammond fumbled at her waist, grabbing for the pistol tucked in her belt. A desperate southpaw punch caught Hammond on the point of the nose. His grip on Mary faltered. He staggered back, blinking away tears. He raised his Sig Sauer and thumbed off the safety. His first shot went wide. Mary and Anne scrambled for cover down a side hallway, chased by gunfire. Julie scurried away, seeking shelter in a shallow alcove in the foyer. Mary pulled her gun and squeezed off four blind shots around the corner, hopeful of hitting Hammond but expecting to merely send him running for cover of his own. She dared to peek. Hammond was gone, and so were the Voldemars,
A trail of bloody footprints led down the hall. "Julie!" Mary called out. "You okay?"
"Go after Valdemar,"
Julie said. She sounded like she had a horrible head cold.
"I'll keep Hammond busy."
"Julie!"
"If he gets to Efron, people will die."
"Shit. Where's your gun?" Mary asked Anne at a whisper.
"I don't know," Anne said, scanning the floor for the lost weapon. "I dropped it."
"Fucking hell.
I'm sorry."
This night was going too smoothly anyway. "Julie, heads up." After another quick peek into the living room, Mary pitched her gun toward the foyer.
"Merci," Julie said. "Now go."
"Don't do anything stupid."
Julie laughed. "I promise nothing."
Julie waited until the gentle thump, thump, thump of departing footsteps faded. She blinked away tears. The world remained blurry, dreamlike.
"Alone at last, Mr. Hammond, just you and me,"
she said, frowning at the alien hardware in her hand. She'd never held a gun in her life, in either of them.
She should have taken this silly thing with her.
"Throw your weapon out,"
Hammond said.
"Oh, I think not."
Julie flicked off the safety. Or did she? The little switch underneath the Glock's side, or whatever it is called, had no label of any kind to indicate whether it was engaged. She pulled back the slide, or whatever, expecting a menacing chick-chick like in the movies. It did make a very similar sound when the slide came off in her hand.
Shit!
Three thick booms punched the air. Julie yelped despite herself. Dust, pulverized drywall, fell on her like a fine winter snow. The wall above her had gained a trio of new holes, about where her head would have been had she been standing. She froze, held her breath, told her heart to stop beating so loudly lest Hammond hear, and did a quick mental tally. 7 shots fired.
Or was it 8? More, maybe? Shit, how many bullets do these blasted things hold anyway?
3 pops of gunfire sounded from somewhere overhead, like a delayed echo of Hammond's salvo.
"Your master is running out of time, Mr. Hammond,"
Julie said, daring to betray her continued existence.
"He can take care of himself," Hammond said.
Julie fumbled with the slide, trying to force it back in place to reform a complete weapon, then tossed the 2 halves aside with a hiss of frustration. More gunfire from above, and then a scream. No, not a scream. A war cry.
"Tell me true, Mr. Hammond," Julie said. "In a contest between your master and my ladies, who do you honestly believe will walk away alive?"
Hammond's answer came as a series of deafening cracks. 4 of them, deliberate in their timing, carefully spaced out to provide maximum cover at minimal expense. The thud of running footsteps followed. Julie got up. She paused, framing herself in the mouth of the hall, and shouted Hammond's name. He whirled, pumped off 2 more shots at empty air. Cursed. Julie sprinted down the length of the hall, sword drawn and trailing behind her like a scorpion's tail. She barreled headlong into a small foyer and put everything behind a rising slash. Hammond ducked under the blade. His head remained on his neck, but he fumbled the fresh magazine pinched between his sweat-slick fingers. Julie danced aside as Hammond threw a punch spiked with his empty firearm, then sprang back with a flurry of quick thrusts. Hammond flinched away from the biting blade with a bark of annoyance, and then pitched his gun at Julie's head. She bobbed out of its path. Hammond fled. Julie pursued. Hammond crashed through a swinging door with a porthole window, his suit jacket half off. Julie burst into a spacious kitchen, much like she'd expect to see in a hospital, all white tile and stainless steel appliances. Hammond, hunkered down and planted, had his jacket wrapped around his left arm. His free hand clutched a butcher's knife that, even in his grip, looked enormous. He parried a light thrust, batting away the point of Julie's sword with his swaddled arm. His knife flashed white, the polished steel catching the overhead lights as he flicked it at Julie's face. She reared back, her legs coiling, and launched herself at Hammond. He punched her sword aside. Julie stumbled, then twisted out of the way of Hammond's counterattack. She spun and laid her sword across the man's broad back. He bit down on a grunt. Red speckled the gleaming white floor.
"First blood is mine, Mr. Hammond," Julie said.
A ghost of a smile played on Hammond's lips. His knife was no longer clean.
Julie became aware of a wet warmth spreading down her left arm. She hadn't even felt the knife slice through her coat and the flesh beneath. She snapped into an en garde, her sword level with Hammond's eyes. Her shoulder tingled painfully. They flitted back and forth, their blades taunting one another. Julie landed a jab, opening a gash above Hammond's eye that dyed the left side of his face crimson. The big man retaliated by hurling the knife. Julie dove out of its path. Hammond closed the gap and threw his weight behind a shoulder ram that took Julie off her feet. Her sword skated musically across the floor, coming to a stop she knew not where. Julie scrambled up onto her hands and knees. Hammond snapped the point of his shoe into her ribs. She flopped onto her back, a wildfire spreading through her abdomen. A reedy squeal leaked out of her mouth. Two more kicks cracked twice as many ribs. Hammond seized Julie by the throat, cutting off what precious little air she could get, hauled her up, and pinned her against the wall. He squeezed. Her head felt like it was swelling to 2, 3, 4 times its size. A red haze settled on her vision. She raised a hand to Hammond's face. His skin was warm to the touch, slick with sweat and fresh blood, and covered by the fine grit of 5 o'clock shadow. Her thumb traced the plane of Hammond's nose, a bony ridge that guided her unerringly to his eye. Hammond's scream was surprisingly high-pitched. The bomb threatening to detonate inside her skull vanished, a little too quickly. Julie collapsed from the ensuing head rush. The tile was cool, soothing, reviving. The world remained covered in a pink-tinged fog, but she could see well enough to make out the dark shape flailing on the floor, almost but not quite within arm's reach. Hammond's knife, however. He rolled up onto his knees, a hand pressed tight to the ruin of his eye, curses and threats of atrocities yet to come erupting from some dark pit in his soul. Julie silenced him, driving the knife home, sliding it up under the hard right angle of Hammond's jaw. He spasmed once and lolled over onto his side, as if laying down for a well-deserved nap. Blood pulsed from the wound, each spurt weaker than the one before it, until it fell to a thick but steady trickle. The world spun. Julie collapsed, the red haze returning. Her lungs rattled with each inhalation. I should have gone out fighting or fucking. Her laugh turned into a coughing fit, her mouth filled with blood. Be careful what you wish for, mademoiselle. The trail of crimson led Mary and Anne down the hall, across a small foyer, and to a carpeted staircase going up. Mary gestured for Anne to stay behind her, stay quiet. Anne nodded and drew her machete. They paused a few steps below the upstairs landing, a short stretch of carpeted hallway. Mary pressed her back to the wall and inched her way up to steal a peek. The trail continued down the hallway and ended in front of a distant door. It felt too obvious. Did Valdemar send Isabel one way to draw their pursuers' attention so he could ambush them from the other? No, she decided. That would mean leaving her alone and unprotected. Mary slipped around the corner, Anne at her heels. They followed the blood. 3 sharp cracks split the air. The women dropped instinctively. Mary, cursing herself, looked back, expecting to see Valdemar bearing down on them, gun in hand. Her panic remained in full force when she realized the gunshots had come from downstairs. Julie, Anne mouthed. Mary, lost for an answer, shook her head. Anne held her position. Mary slinked past the door to flank it on the opposite side. Breathe in. 3, 4. Valdemar! Mary shouted. Bullets peppered the door, punching clean through the wood but doing little damage on the way through. The veneer barely splintered around the neat little holes. 3 neat little holes, to be precise. 14 shots left by Mary's count. Valdemar said something. She couldn't tell what exactly. The door muffled his voice. But the tone struck her as urgent. A command, perhaps.
We have to get in there, Anne said.
Mary told Anne what to do and when to do it. Anne nodded. Roaring, Mary drove her foot into the door, just to the right of the doorknob, kicking it wide open. Mary jumped clear and let Valdemar exhaust 5 more bullets. They stormed the bedroom, Mary bolting left, Anne right. Erkan opened fire. Bullets stitched along the wall in Mary's wake. Anne charged, machete raised. Erkan pivoted and pulled the trigger on an empty weapon. He dodged, almost too late, and shoved Anne away. He dropped the gun and scrambled to grab the katana hanging in its new place of honor above his bed. Erkan threw the scabbard aside and zeroed in on Anne, his sword carving a pattern in the air around him. She backpedaled, her eyes wide, as if mesmerized by the gleaming blade. Mary went for Erkan's flank. He twisted, batting the attack aside, then reversed his momentum to return the blow. Mary threw herself out of the way. Anne circled around to Erkan's rear. He countered, only to end up turning his back to Mary. He countered again, whirling his katana in an almost leisurely manner, the razor tip ever in motion, ready to strike should one foe or the other make a move.
"You come into my home," Erkan growled. "Threaten me. Maim my wife."
"Then do something about it," Mary said. "Fight like a man." "Or die like a dog," Anne said. Erkan lashed out, driving Mary back and drawing Anne in. He swung the katana around in a lethal arc. Anne grasped her machete with both hands and braced for the impact. A fat spark flared into and winked out of existence as the blades skated off one another. Erkan popped Anne in the cheek with the point of his elbow, raising an instant welt. She replied with a wild swipe that sent Erkan springing away, and toward Mary, who drew a neat red line down Erkan's back, slicing him open from the shoulder blade to the crest of his hip bone. Cursing, Erkan whirled about, his katana singing. Mary sidestepped. The sword bit into the floor. Mary brought her machete down with all her strength behind it, snapping the katana in half. Anne threw a kick into Erkan's ribs. He yelped, a coarse and breathless sound. Mary looped a fist into the base of his skull. Erkan collapsed, burbling incoherently, his eyes unfocused. "Watch him," Mary said, looking around. The bedroom was spacious but sparsely furnished. Places to hide were few. In the towering wardrobe, under the bed. A trail of bloody smears led to the bathroom. The doorknob, a smooth globe of clear glass, turned without resistance. Isabel, ghostly pale and wild-eyed, slumped against the side of an antique clawfoot bathtub. An empty bottle of rubbing alcohol lay on its side nearby. A towel wrapped haphazardly around her foot was soaked through with red. "Lady Valdemar," Mary said. Isabel eyed the machete in Mary's hand. "Are you going to kill me now?" Isabel asked without a trace of fear. "Let's find out." She removed Isabel from the bathroom, dragging her across the floor by the hair like a cartoon caveman. Isabel growled with animalistic rage, but did not cry out. "Get up, Valdemar," Anne said, tucking the remainder of his katana in her belt as a trophy. Erkan gave his head a vigorous shake and rolled up onto his knees. Anne stopped him there. Mary released Isabel and snatched Erkan's phone off the nightstand. "It took 7 strokes to separate Ham's head from his shoulders," she said, raising her machete high. All that was missing was a headman's block. "Make the call, or you get to see how many it'll take to decapitate your wife."
"Don't do it," Isabel said to her husband.
"Look at me, Valdemar." Mary stepped on Isabel's back, pinning her. "You know I'll do it." Erkan, grimacing, said,
"Yes, I know that now."
Mary tossed the phone over. Erkan put the call on speakerphone.
"Mr. Manish," he said, without the slightest hitch or tremor, "I have some excellent news. Our new associate, the one who favors Blue."
"Ah, yes," Manish said. "Of course."
"She's completed the task I set for her, and quite impressively. The thorn in my side has been removed, permanently."
Mary fancied she could hear Manish's jaw drop open.
"It has?"
"She presented me with irrefutable proof of her success this very evening. It will make a wonderful centerpiece to my collection."
"I'm sure it will, sir."
"But I didn't call simply to boast. We've had a lengthy discussion, my associate and I, and she's expressed an interest in staying on
in a more official capacity.
She has?
Manish said, more skepticism than surprise in the question. There was a great deal of soul-searching on her part, but she's come to recognize the valuable role I play in keeping the peace, Erkan said. I believe her to be acting in good faith, and in the spirit of reciprocity, I'd like to extend a good faith gesture of my own. Recall our contractors immediately.
Sir?
Erkan beheld his wife, prostrate and helpless under Mary's boot. His face reddened. Mary gave a slow shake of her head, a final warning.
You heard me, Mr. Manish. Our leverage is no longer necessary. Recall our contractors. Do it now. Please.
Yes, sir, Manish said. A minute passed. Two.
It's done, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Manish, Erkan said.
Will there be anything else, sir?
That's all for now. Good night, Mr. Manish.
Good night, sir.
The line fell silent. Now what, Sergeant? Erkan said. You've done what I asked. I've done what you asked. Where do we go from here? I dare say neither of us can completely trust the other at this point.
Mary lowered her machete and took her foot off Isabel.
Isabel sat up, her features stony.
Probably not, Mary said. But we don't need trust, do we? Neither of us can betray the other without betraying ourselves.
True.
Cautiously, Erkan stood. Anne reared back, ready to lop his head off at the tiniest provocation.
I think the question then becomes, which of us is willing to sacrifice everything in the name of revenge?
Oh, I believe we both know the answer to that, Mr. Valdemar, Mary said with a humorless smile. Isabel's mouth fell open in a silent scream as Mary rammed her machete up under Erkan's sternum to cleave through the heart beneath. Shock leapt onto Erkan's features and fell away as quickly. His final breath escaped as a husky laugh. As he dropped, the fine hairs on the back of Mary's neck prickled, as if the air itself had become charged with electricity. She looked to Anne to ask if she felt it too, but the look on her face made that answer clear. They turned. Isabel Valdemar rose, her chalky complexion turning ruddy before Mary's eyes. Her hands curled into talons, and they trembled with rage building to critical mass.
Kurva! She spat, lurching toward the women. Karho zatosh kurva!
She lunged, screaming, her claws ready to shred flesh. Mary slipped out of her path, clearing Anne to deliver a fist to Isabel's temple. Isabel reeled, hands instinctively grasping for something to hold on to. She found the hilt of her husband's katana and drew it from Anne's belt. Isabel brandished the weapon clumsily, waving it about as if chasing a pesky fly, all the while spewing invective in a muddle of some unknown language and English heavily accented by some Eastern European tongue. She hugged the edge of the room, inching toward the open doorway.
Isabel, Mary said, put it down.
Gilkosh, you killed my husband! You killed my husband!
She sobbed, and something inside Mary cracked.
Isabel, please, put it down.
She sheathed her machete. It doesn't have to end like this.
It will not end like this. It will not end until one of us is dead.
Isabel leveled her blade at Mary, a judge passing her death sentence.
I will see you in hell.
Julie appeared in the doorway as a silhouette.
After you, dear, she said, pressing the tip of her sword to Isabel's spine.
Julie guided her back inside, into the light, and Mary and Anne gasped at the sight of their friend. Blood caked her lips and chin, and one sleeve of her long coat glistened wetly.
Fucking hell, Mary said.
Isabel whipped around. The katana bit deep into the meat of Julie's upper arm. She cried out and crashed to her knees, her right shoulder rapidly becoming a match for the left. Isabel slipped past her and disappeared into the hallway.
Shit,
Anne said, rushing to Julie's side. Mary ducked into the bathroom and grabbed every towel within sight.
We need to leave,
Julie croaked.
Not yet.
Mary knelt to wrap a towel around the freshest of Julie's wounds.
Yes, yet. The police won't...
It's not the police we need to worry about.
Julie's smile was almost sheepish.
I may have set the house on fire.
While it hadn't been part of her plan, Mary had to admit that a spontaneous act of arson was the right call. Julie soaked Hammond's body, a wealth of forensic evidence, with cooking oil to get things going, and trailed a liquid fuse of oil into the downstairs hallway. The carpet obligingly caught right away, and by the time Mary and Anne reached the bottom of the main stairwell, a barely conscious Julie hanging between them, the fire was licking up the walls. With a heartfelt apology, Mary laid Julie in the trunk of the car. It would be easier to clean than the upholstery, and ran back inside to strategically aid the blaze in spreading. She found in a downstairs den, among an impressive collection of scotch and bourbon, a crystal decanter of top-shelf brandy. She doused Erkan Valdemar. Valdemar en flambé, she thought, giggling despite herself, to ensure the fire would do as much damage to him as possible. She found the two guns that were not hers, and tossed them into the hall leading to the kitchen, now transformed into a roaring blast furnace. Her own weapon, with its directly traceable serial number, that would have to be disposed of more carefully. Something inside the kitchen exploded with a low pop. Mary ran. Anne met her on the front porch, and she pointed at nothing in particular. "Sirens," Anne said. Mary listened. There they were, in the distance but approaching fast. "We have to go." They passed the first fire engine less than a mile from the house. Mary watched it pass in her rearview mirror, watched it race toward a brightening glow bleeding up into the night sky. Bleeding. Julie. Anne opened the door. Mother stepped inside and thrust a plastic shopping bag into her hands.
"Where is she?" Mother said.
Anne led her into the bathroom. Mary spared Mother a glance and then returned her attention to Julie. They'd fashioned the bathtub into a makeshift sickbed, laying down as a serviceable mattress, a thick winter comforter Mary suspected she'd never use for that purpose again. No amount of laundering would remove that much blood. Calvin, she learned to her annoyance, had taken most of the blankets, but left their electric blanket, which now bore an impressionist rendition of Julie's body. A bloody shroud of Turin.
"Here," Anne said, handing the CVS bag over.
Mary dumped the contents onto the floor and then peeled the blanket away. Julie, naked from the waist up, did not stir as Mary removed the towel wrapped awkwardly around her shoulder. The gash beneath seeped steadily.
"You've had an eventful evening," Mother remarked.
"Not now, Mother," Mary said.
"She needs a hospital."
"They'll ask too many questions."
"Will there be fewer questions if she dies?"
Mary carefully spilled rubbing alcohol onto Julie's wound. She drew a small, sharp breath. "She's not going to die," Mary said.
"Do not make promises you cannot keep, my dear sergeant,"
Julie whispered.
"Shh, save your strength."
Julie's eyes fluttered open. She gave Mother a feeble but heartfelt smile.
"You still came, even after I stopped eating."
"What?" Mary said. Julie sank back into semi-consciousness without answering. Mary worked in silence, cleaning Julie's wounds, slathering them with antibiotic ointment, sealing them shut as best she could with butterfly closures. They'd scar, badly, but they weren't the greatest concern. That would be the ugly mottled blue and purple stain spreading across Julie's midsection, and the wet rattle that accompanied every breath.
"She needs a hospital," Mother said again. "She has broken ribs."
"I know," Mary said.
"If one of them has punctured a lung."
"I know, goddammit, I know. But I don't know what... It fell upon her then, the crushing weight of the night's events, of the atrocities she'd committed in the name of what she told herself over and over was a just cause, of what it cost her, and might yet cost her. She sank to her knees, weeping. Anne knelt down and took her love in her arms.
"Mother," Anne said.
"Go," Mother said. Anne nodded a thank you. She coaxed Mary to her feet and led her out.
Mother sat on the edge of the tub. She sighed and caressed Julie's cheek. It was hot to the touch.
"Here we are again," Julie murmured, "at the end of all things." "And what makes you think this is the end?" Mother asked.
"You are here."
"I am. That might not mean what you think it does."
Julie opened her eyes just for a moment and smiled.
"But it might."
"Let's find out, shall we?" Mother laid a gentle hand on Julie's head. "Perhaps we'll both be surprised." Anne sat Mary down on the couch and settled in beside her, one arm around her shoulders.
"What have I done?" Mary said. She looked down at her hands, tinted pastel red by Julie's blood.
She willed them to stop trembling. They disobeyed.
"What you had to do," Anne said.
"What I had to do?" Mary shook her head. "I didn't have to murder two men in cold blood. I didn't have to brutalize some poor woman."
"One of those men was ready to do the same to you. Worse to you. And you put him down, like he deserved."
"You went too far. This was too far," Mary said, but not to Anne. Her gaze was fixed somewhere, on someone else.
I know that, but..."
"No, you don't get to let me off the hook like that. This is on me as much as it's on you." Mary fell silent, her head cocked as if straining to hear a faint, distant sound. And then she looked at Anne.
"Yeah," Mary said.
"Me too."
"Mary?" Anne said.
"I..."
Mary's eyelids fluttered.
"I don't know."
Mother padded across the room as silently as a cat and settled onto the couch.
"Julie's asleep. You'd do well to follow her lead, both of you. I'll watch over her."
"Will she be all right?" Mary asked.
"I can't say."
"I don't want her to die because of me."
"Julie Daubigny has done precious little in her life for anyone but herself. If she dies, mourn her. But take comfort knowing that she died for something, for someone she believed in," Mother said.
But Mary had fallen fast asleep and was beyond hearing. XXVII. The following day was a torturous vigil on two fronts. Julie's temperature spiked into fever territory during the night. Mother filled the tub with cool water, which instantly turned into a grisly soup, and sat nearby on the off chance the insensate Julie threatened to sink beneath the surface. Come morning, Mary and Anne took turns draining and refilling the tub and watching over their friend, who periodically emerged from her slumber long enough to take sips of water and, with difficulty, swallow over-the-counter painkillers. When she slept, she seemed at peace. The same could not be said for Mary, who, when she was not tending to Julie, paced laps around her apartment, pausing at every window, expecting to see police cruisers surrounding the house. They'd find out. Maybe not today. Almost certainly not today. Police didn't work with the miraculous speed of their TV counterparts. But eventually they would find out. Somewhere there was a witness waiting to talk. Video taken by a security camera she failed to spot. A fingerprint or a hair that somehow escaped the raging pyre that, according to that morning's telegram, had destroyed half of the Valdemar house and apparently killed two people yet to be positively identified. The newspaper offered precious little insight as to the state of the investigation. A single line indicated the state fire marshal had deemed the fire suspicious, a well-worn go-to statement among law enforcement and public safety officials whenever they had no idea what was going on. Chief Drennan himself was the source of similar generic noncommittal quotes that appeared in the day's top story. The discovery of multiple bodies inside an old factory on the south side of the city. The write-up was skimpy on critical details, but generously padded to rationalize its front-page status. 911 call leads police to mass grave, the headline announced, somewhat misleadingly. The phrase, "We are unable to comment at this time," appeared no fewer than six times. That would change.
the floodgates would open soon enough. Mary glanced out the window. Anne, armed with a bucket of hot water and bleach and a scrub brush, worked on the trunk of her Mazda, busily erasing recent damning history. If only it were that easy. By the end of the day, the remains found at the Valdemar house had yet to be positively identified. By the end of the day, the police had yet to storm the apartment and take Mary and Anne away in handcuffs. By the end of the day, Julie d'Aubigny had yet to die. 2 more days passed. In keeping with her lifelong penchant for brazenly defying expectations, Julie remained alive. Her fever broke late in the afternoon of the second day, soon after Mary returned home from work, at which point Julie demanded to be removed from the tub as she was quite done with stewing in my own juices. Mary ran a warm shower and gently scrubbed Julie clean, and with Anne's assistance lifted her up and out of the tub. The short trip to the couch drained away what little energy Julie had. She slept soundly for 2 hours, wrapped up in Mary's lush terrycloth bathrobe, before waking to the smell of canned chicken soup. She gratefully and greedily devoured a bowl and asked for more. "Let's give this a few minutes," Mary said. "Make sure you can keep it down." "No, you are correct," Julie shifted with a grunt and then settled back with a sigh. She gave Mary a crooked smile. "You look exhausted." "It's been a hectic week." "You don't say." "Aside from the obvious, I mean. We've thrown the city into quite the tizzy." As Mary expected, the positive identification of Erkan Valdemar's body, through dental records, sparked a city-wide shitstorm, of which the Worcester Police Department became the relatively stable center. While the command staff dealt with the media onslaught, detectives handled the flood of phone calls from the general public, responding in force to a request for tips after the state fire marshal publicly upgraded his initial assessment of the Valdemar blaze from suspicious to intentionally set. "The investigation is unofficially, temporarily on hold." "Sorry," Mary said. "Investigations, plural." With the fire marshal taking point on the alleged arson, the detectives shifted their focus onto their other big case, the alleged mass homicide, at the former Affiliated Plastics of Worcester Incorporated. Of the 7 bodies recovered, 6 had been tentatively identified through police mugshots. Known car thieves Richard Moby Mantle and Tamir Ray Johnson. Heroin dealer and sometime police informant Alder Murph the Narc Murphy. Pimp and suspected human trafficker Leo Eden. Small-time oxy pusher Arnold Park. And a meth dealer named Desmond Lamp. The lack of a head made identification of body number 7 problematic.
"But it will not take your detectives long to put 2 and 2 together," Julie said. "So to speak."
"They already have," Mary said. "Not officially, but when you find a body without a head in one part of the city and a head without a body in another."
"Do they have any suspects?"
"Everyone and no one. The detectives are still trying to figure out what happened. They haven't quite gotten to the who part."
"In other words, they haven't connected any of this to us?" Anne said.
"No," Mary said, but without conviction. She'd heard things, of course, the benefit of being on the periphery of the investigations. But the detectives, following the chief's directive, were being more discreet than usual in the interest of keeping the pipeline to the media under tight control.
"But that's good, isn't it? I've always heard that if police don't have a suspect within the first 48 hours of a murder investigation, chances of finding one drop by half."
"And it has been at least 48 hours, Julie added.
"That's not how it works," Mary said. "Cases like these start out at a sprint but often turn into a marathon. We could be arrested tomorrow, next year, or 10 years from now." Or as soon as Aldwyn decided it was safe to drop an anonymous tip from wherever he'd abruptly disappeared to. Assuming his disappearance was of his own making, of course.
"Or never," Anne offered. "We were careful. But we weren't perfect. No one is."
Mary brightened ever so slightly. "Once the detectives positively identify Ham's remains, things are going to get even crazier. They'll try to figure out how Ham was connected to Valdemar. They'll eventually connect Valdemar to the factory. That will draw both investigations in completely different directions.
Away from us? Anne said.
Hopefully.
Anne reached across Julie to take Mary's hand. Whatever happens, I'll be with you.
I know, Mary said.
As will I, my dear sergeant, Julie said, slipping her hand into the clasp. My dear friend.
The women sat in silence, hands intertwined, and gazed out the window. The sky glowed with a rich, warm amber hue, the setting sun reflecting off low cloud cover, heralding an approaching storm. Mary opened her eyes at 4:30 a.m. on the nose, despite the fact she'd not set the alarm. Her body had again gotten used to waking up for first shift duty. She slid out from under Anne's arm. Anne murmured in her sleep and pulled Mary's pillow into a hug, a habit she'd developed recently. Mary shrugged on her bathrobe and crept into the living room, on tiptoes to avoid disturbing Julie, only to find she'd already risen for the day. The couch was empty, her blanket folded neatly atop her borrowed pillow. Laid atop that was a piece of notebook paper covered in elegant script.
My dear Sergeant, with 2 weeks of peace behind us and no signs that your comrades-in-arms are looking in our direction, I decided tonight was as good a time as any to move on. Should fate take a cruel turn, you have but to call me and I shall return to stand by your side. My vow is my bond to you, my good and true friend. Until that time, however, I plan to resume my self-appointed quest to find others like us. They are out there, perhaps in need of a guiding hand. Having been once lost myself, I believe that no one is better suited to fill that role than I. I realize that after all we have experienced together, it must seem callous of me to sneak away like a thief in the night and leave behind this most impersonal of farewells. But goodbyes have never been easy for me. Call me a coward if you will. I would deserve it. But please know that your hospitality, your patience, and your steadfast friendship means the world to me. I have found as much love with you and with Miss Bonny as I have known in the course of 2 lives. For that I will be forever in your debt. Be well, my dear Sergeant, and be happy. La M.
Do you have any idea where she went? Mary asked.
An idea, Mother said. But I can't say for certain. Julie d'Aubigny and predictability have always been mutually exclusive. If I hear from her, I will let you know.
Thank you. It'd be nice to have one less thing on my mind.
And what is on your mind these days?
I don't know what's on my mind. I don't even know whose mind I have. Mary sagged in her chair. Nothing in my life feels right anymore. But nothing feels wrong either.
Yourselves are reconciling. You'll feel conflicted for some time, but eventually all the pieces of Rose Booker and Mary Reed will find a way to fit together to form a new whole. In the meantime, all you can do is find those pieces that already feel right and build on those. It's a messy process, but I have faith you'll get it right.
Mother flicked her hand.
Go home. You have better people to spend your evening with than me.
Anne was already in bed when Mary got home. She disrobed and slipped under the covers. Anne opened a bleary eye and grunted a question.
Sorry, Mary said. Didn't mean to wake you.
It's okay, Anne mumbled. Did Mother know where Julie went?
No. Oh.
I can't say I'm surprised. I'm sure she'll pop up again.
Like a bad penny.
It's her style.
Yeah, Anne agreed.
What about you?
What about me?
Are you all right?
Mother says I'll be of two minds, somewhat literally, for a while. But it'll sort itself out. I guess I won't really be Rose anymore. But I won't be Mary either.
She made a thoughtful noise.
Maybe I'll take Julie's advice and split the difference. Rosemary.
Rosemary?
I should get used to it easily enough. It is my given name, after all.
I didn't know that.
I almost never use my full name. I've gone by Rose since I was a kid.
I always thought Mary sounded wrong. Isn't that funny?
Yeah.